come as you are, and inescapably, you must come if you would be yourself. Of others, ask no more or less. No one is better or worse than another, for no one has lived the life of the other. If you have doubts, bring them with you. If you have hope, bring that with you also. Come as you are and let doubt, hope, and faith sit side by side until there comes the feeling that in the depth of understanding and feeling, we are one. Welcome to the penultimate summer service. One more week of summer services. Next week, the Social Justice Committee will take over. Jerry Phelan and Kay Meyer will be speaking, really a follow-up on this morning's message. And after that service, on the 13th, we will begin our first service in our phase one, a return to seeing people in the sanctuary. I'm looking out right now, and I see Donica sitting there and a bunch of empty pews. So on the 13th, that is going to change. Hopefully all of you saw the notice is coming out about the fact that we're going to begin gradually moving back into using our facility, first step being services on the 13th, socially distant, congregation masked. We look forward to that. I want to welcome today our guest speaker, Kaylee McCauley. And Kaylee's got a powerful message for us. She introduces herself really when she speaks, so I don't need to do too much to introduce her. But the one thing I will say is Kaylee is starting a nursing program at North Central Technical College right now, and I feel a certain kinship with her because of that. I told her it was 43 years ago that I began that particular program. So good luck, Kaylee. Over the last several services that I've done, I introduced myself as various roles within the congregation. I am Randy Jefferson. Today I'm going to greet you as a member of the choir. The choir has almost every week since we began this new way of communicating with one another and having service and trying to keep one another going through this difficult period. We have had weekly Zoom meetings where we have greeted one another and exchanged what's happening to us during that period of time, and we have sung. Margaret plays the piano, and each of us in our homes on mute, we sing. And we often talk about how we look forward to being back here eventually when we're able to actually sing together, which we won't be able to do when we first start to gather. But it'll be wonderful when we can get back together and sing. Gathered here in the mystery of the hour, gathered here in one strong body, gathered here in the struggle and the power, Spirit, draw near. In the spirit of that unity, let's join together, each of you in your homes or wherever you might be. If you're near something you can light your candle as we share our chalice lighting words. We light this chalice for the light of truth, the warmth of love, and the fire of commitment. We light this symbol of our faith as we gather together. Now, Donica and Margaret, they were good enough again to agree to record something that had not been recorded before. And there was a song in our hymnal that I thought was especially appropriate for this morning's service. It's in the Freedom section. The hymn is I Wish I Knew How. It was written by Billy Taylor. Some of you might know Billy Taylor. I know Margaret is a big fan. Billy Taylor was a jazz pianist and composer. And this particular song became quite popular during the civil rights movement in the 50s and 60s. Thank you. For a reading this morning, I took excerpts from Ibram X. Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. Ann and I have started I'm not sure what to call it exactly. I wouldn't call it a tradition, but I guess a habit of almost every day we try to sit down and have tea together mid-afternoon. And it's a time to chat a bit and talk about some things that are on our mind. And one of the things we decided to do recently was to form a two-person book group. And we read How to Be an Anti-Racist. And during those tea periods, we've been talking about Kendi's book and the kinds of things that struck us in there that were things we wanted to share with one another and talk about a little more depth. And I decided for today's service in consultation with Kaylee that I would take brief excerpts from How to Be an Anti-Racist and share some of these thoughts that Kendi has with you. He begins by really defining an anti-racist. Kendi writes, "An anti-racist is one who is expressing the idea that racial groups are equals and none needs developing, and is supporting policy that reduces racial inequality." And again, each of these statements will be ones that I've extracted from different sections of the book. Kendi writes, "It is one of the ironies of anti-racism that we must identify racially in order to identify the racial privileges and dangers of being in our bodies. There is no such thing as racial ancestry. Ethnic ancestry does exist. Ethnic groups in Western Africa are more genetically similar to ethnic groups in Western Europe than to ethnic groups in Eastern Africa. Race is a genetic mirage. To be anti-racist is also to recognize the living, breathing reality of this racial mirage, which makes our skin colors more meaningful than our individuality. To be anti-racist is to focus on ending the racism that shapes the mirage, not to ignore the mirages that shape people's lives. To be anti-racist is to view the inequalities between all racialized groups as a problem of policy. The problem of race has always been at its core the problem of power, not the problem of immorality or ignorance. Once they clearly benefit, most Americans will support and become the defenders of the anti-racist policies they once feared." And to finish, Kendi writes, "To fight for mental and moral changes after policy is changed means fighting alongside growing benefits and the dissipation of fears, making it possible for anti-racist power to succeed. To fight for mental and moral change as a prerequisite for policy change is to fight against growing fears and apathy, making it almost impossible for anti-racist power to succeed. The original power of racism has not been solved by suasion. Knowledge is only power if knowledge is put to the struggle for power. Changing minds is not a movement. Critiquing racism is not activism. Changing minds is not activism. And activism produces power and policy change, not mental change. If a person has no record of power or policy change, then that person is not an activist." Here ends the reading.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Kaylee McCauley. I am 20 years old. I work as a behavioral health technician at North Central Healthcare, and I am a nursing student at North Central Technical College. I'm honored to have this opportunity to share some of my experiences with you this morning. For those of you who aren't familiar with me, I am biracial. My dad is black and my mom is white. I was born in Chattanooga, Tennessee, but I was raised here in central Wisconsin by my white grandparents. My grandma was a surgery technician, and my grandpa was a pharmacist, and they did well for themselves. Looking back, I think in many ways my younger brother Isaac and I were shielded from some of the harsh realities many people of color face, in large part because of my grandparents' privilege. As I got older, my grandparents couldn't be with me at every turn, and that's when I started to become more conscious of my identity, especially since I noticed that the world around me did too. The first instance that comes to mind for me was when I was around 15 years old. I was in my sophomore year of high school. My best friend at the time got her first serious boyfriend. We'd always been very close and had rarely any issues in our relationship until it became apparent to me that her boyfriend was prejudiced. The first time I met him before I introduced myself, he asked me, "Shouldn't you be in the fields?" It didn't even register with me what he could be alluding to. I remember thinking, "Doing what? I wonder what that's supposed to mean." My friend and her boyfriend carried on their conversation, and it wasn't until after this exchange where I realized what he was trying to say to me. I clued my friend into this, and I said, "That was kind of messed up for him to say to me, don't you think?" And she had responded with, "Yeah, I guess." I was angry about his casual racism and her casual response to it. These kinds of remarks and jokes continued, like when I remember him later saying to me, "Don't make me crack the whip at you." I was apprehensive about saying something out of fear of causing issues between my friend and I. As a person of color, you expect to encounter discrimination. What I wasn't expecting was my friend, who I had known for years, to side with her prejudiced boyfriend when I brought it to her attention that the remarks were hurtful and offensive to me. She told me if I was that bothered by it, I should say something for myself. Other times, she even laughed at the jokes, too. There was an opportunity for her to be an ally to me, and she didn't take it. I realized through a lot of discomfort, humiliation, and unexpressed anger that these kinds of microaggressions were not only common, but accepted among high school students. When I was 17 years old, I got my nursing assistant license and began working at a long-term care facility here in Wausau. I remember a time when I was at the nurse's station, and the facility's two assistant nursing directors were talking to me. One of them said, "The funniest thing happened today." And then she proceeded to tell a story about how a resident had been visited by some family today. It was the resident's granddaughter and her mixed black kids who had came to see her that day. The resident had told her granddaughter that she didn't like black people. Keep in mind, this resident was in her late 90s and had dementia. The assistant director of nursing is telling this story and laughing, and I'm standing at the nurse's station wondering what about this situation is funny. I'm waiting to see if the other assistant director of nursing is going to interject with something telling her that this isn't appropriate, because I can tell by the look on her face that she's uncomfortable too. She didn't say anything. I walked away, and I immediately reported her to my administrator. A couple of hours later, I was pulled off of the floor to a meeting with the administrator, the director of nursing, and both of the assistant director of nursing for my facility, and I had to explain to her why what she said was inappropriate. I felt my stomach drop walking into the room. I'm now the only minority in the room, and I'm having to have this conversation with all of the leadership staff in my facility. And I explained to them that it wasn't appropriate because despite the family member knowing why their elderly grandma was saying those things, it didn't make it any less hurtful to have her look at her grandchildren and not want them around. I also went on to explain that they don't realize this, but I was one of two or three minority staff members in the entire building. I've gone into rooms and have had patients call me the N-word. Patients ask me where I'm from, and when I say I'm from here in the U.S., they're surprised or don't believe me at all. I've been called colored and a Negro. I've had patients reassure me that I still look pretty white. I still do my job, of course, but have you ever had to shower, feed, or care for someone after they called you a nigger? Have you ever had to display humanity and consideration to somebody who doesn't see yours? These are the things that happen on the job on a day-to-day basis, and despite me letting it roll off my back, it doesn't mean that it's not tiring for me. I can tolerate residents who are elderly and coming from a different value system or generation, or who may have cognitive issues making remarks, but I couldn't tolerate leadership staff who are veteran nurses saying those things and using them as punchlines for a laugh. I explained this as tactfully as possible at the time, and I'd like to think that the staff was receptive to what I said. But after we were leaving the room, the other nursing director assistant pulled me aside to let me know that what the nurse had said at the time was inappropriate. This is really how people view allyship. Quiet agreement behind the scenes to people of color, which ultimately is very self-serving and makes them feel okay about their inaction. If she felt what the nurse said was inappropriate, she should have vocalized that at the time. She was the staff member who was her equal, and she wasn't the minority. Telling me after the fact that she didn't like what was said doesn't help me and doesn't alleviate the burden that falls on me to speak up. I needed her to be an ally to me in the moment, to put herself on the line in front of her coworker, to not leave me alone in the burden of calling out this inappropriate racism and having to do so in a room full of white superiors. This was not the first time the onus fell on me to speak up. In October of 2018, some images and videos were circulating of a white man in blackface with fake dreads, a basketball jersey, and Pall Mall cigarettes rubber banded to his wrist, standing in the middle of a circle of white guys calling him the N-word, was all on my social medias. The first I had seen this was when somebody I had called a friend posted a picture with the guy in blackface, along with a caption that said, "He sure fits in well with the ghetto." There was another friend of mine that took a picture with the guy in blackface and posted it. I was completely shocked by what I was seeing. Blackface has always been done to dehumanize black people. These mocking portrayals of black people are intended to illustrate us as inferior and perpetuate negative stereotypes, and here I have supposed friends and people in my community thinking this is hilarious, and not only that, sharing it on social media with no expectation for backlash. That's how normalized we are to discrimination. Even the most blatantly obvious acts of racism do not sound the alarm for some people. I'd wrestled back and forth with myself if I should make a post condemning behavior, and I had settled that I needed to call out this bad behavior. While there were people who shared my viewpoint, I was shocked to see a great number of people who saw what was happening as a joke and not a big deal, and making justification after justification for their behavior. During all of this, I had had conversations with my old high school principal and the superintendent about what educational measures could be taken so that these things don't continue to happen. It's larger than just the boys using slurs and being in blackface. It's about dressing up like that at a party and nobody saying anything. It's about posting it on social media and nobody seeing a problem with it. It's about a person of color trying to bring attention to the problematic nature of the conduct, and rather than being rallied around, they're met with racial gaslighting. It's that I live in a community that permits behavior like this. Another situation took place in the workplace where I was at the nurse's station charting when one of the nurses came up to me and she said she was going to be assessing a patient before they came on the unit. They'd stepped off the unit to do the assessment and came back to let me know that the patient seemed like one of the thug types. I'm sitting at the nurse's station shocked and confused. So I say, "I'm sorry, what?" The nurse replies back with, "You know, one of those rapper types." I go on to ask her, "They're a rapper? How did you know? Did they say they were a rapper?" The nurse says, "Well, no, I guess I'm being kind of judgy." I'm thinking, judgy? Is that the word we're using for stereotyping now? Shortly after this exchange, we're getting ready to bring the patient on the unit. However, whenever a new patient comes on the unit, we have to do what is called a skin check, where the patient has to strip off their clothes so that we can verify that they don't have any paraphernalia or weapons on them. Many patients are not comfortable with this already, and this particular patient coming in was highly confused and delusional. The patient refused to do the skin check and was becoming elevated, so they ended up having to be put in a restraint chair and the seclusion room for safety purposes. I was in the room with several other white staff when the patient said, "You're just doing this to me because I'm black." The nurse who was making the stereotypical comments earlier interjects with, "Oh no, don't pull the race card. That's not what this is." Some of the other white staff seem to think this exchange is funny. And then the patient looks at me and says, "You're supposed to be one of me, but you're helping them." I went to the patient and I'm talking to him about how I understand 100% where he's coming from. But we also have to focus on getting him out of the chair so that we can have an actual conversation at the table. After this whole ordeal, I'm honestly beyond disturbed. I think about if I hadn't been there, who would have tried to connect with this patient who was confused and distressed? How many times have they been targeted in their life to make them feel like this situation is happening to them because they are black and not because they need help? No, we weren't putting the patient in the restraint chair because he was black, but also moments before he came in, stereotypical terms like thug and rapper were being used amongst the staff. It's not okay. And it's not okay that I was again the only person who saw a problem with this. It's not okay that seasoned healthcare professionals are thinking and talking this way. It truly compromises the care we provide and undermines our professionalism and is an example of medical racism at work in our community. Another time I came into work and the nurses, psychiatrists, and social workers were chatting at the nurse's station. I'm logging into my computer, only half listening to the conversation, when I hear one of the social workers talking about how she was at a convention for social workers, but she couldn't figure out why there was a Black Social Workers Association. She said to everyone at the desk, "This black power stuff is getting out of control." Once again, I can't believe what I'm hearing. A social worker of all people can't figure out why there needs to be a Black Social Workers Association? Unbeknownst to her, it's for instances just like these. It's for patients just like the one I described before. I remember one of my coworkers had glanced back at me, and I'm not sure if it was because she was looking to see if I would say anything or if she was looking to see if she should say something. But she said nothing. Nobody at the desk said anything about it. In fact, once again, I believe some people laughed. I didn't say anything, and I kicked myself for it. It's stressful, though, and not to mention exhausting and demoralizing, to always have to be the one to speak up as the minority, and in many instances that I'm describing, the subordinate, and also as one of the youngest employees in my facility. Why should I have to constantly be the one to defend black people, especially to people who have more experience, years, and authority than me? Some of you are going to listen to these stories I've shared today and be dismayed at my friends and coworkers' lack of support and intervention. But I'm here to tell you, though, many of you have been that friend yourselves, whether it be you, somebody in your family, a colleague, or a friend that said something discriminatory. You sat back and you said nothing. You did nothing. You challenged nothing. And you might have even laughed. You co-signed the behavior with your silence, and I hope that you know I can see you. Your friends of color, they can see what you choose to say, and they can see what you choose not to say, who you choose to defend and not defend, whether it be on social media or in person. I've been watching all my life. We still see you when you deliberately choose not to hear us. Ally is a verb, not a noun. It requires you to do something, to say something. In the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., there comes a time when silence is betrayal. I've done the cost-benefit analysis, and I have concluded that my silence will not protect me. I've got to speak up on behalf of my black and brown community. Some of you have also calculated that same risk, and you found that your silence will protect you. That, in essence, is white privilege. If you are unable to have conversations as a white person with other white people about race, you are not an ally. Is it scary to have tough conversations? For sure. I know it's hard because I've had to do it, and so many times not out of choice, but out of necessity. However, this is where the change happens. This is where the growth happens. You can sacrifice some social discomfort because the lives and well-being of people of color depend on it. And so here are some questions that I feel like it would benefit everyone to reflect on. Am I ready to hold people accountable for the things that they say and do, including myself? Am I ready to have difficult conversations about discrimination and privilege, especially with people who are close to me and with people who I call friends? What can I do to educate myself today about these topics? And if I'm not ready, what do I need to do to become ready to have these conversations? So thank you all for taking the time to listen to my story and my perspective. I sincerely hope that this moves some of you to end the silence and the complicity and the betrayal. And I'll close with a quote from Layla Raven, one of my favorite writers and activists. She said, "When someone offers you an opportunity to be accountable, it is an act of care. It is an acknowledgement of your humanity and your capacity to transform behaviors. Listen, learn, and say thank you." This is me extending that opportunity.
Thank you, Kaylee, for that strong and challenging message. I'd like to share a prayer with you now. This is a prayer written by Marjolie Bélezère. Originally from Haiti, 2013, she first discovered Unitarian Universalism, became a UU minister, and is now an associate minister. She wrote this prayer recently. It's entitled Prayer for While in the Struggle. Spirit of light and love, spirit of resistance, spirit of generosity, that which serves as our conscience in this work that we do to dismantle white supremacy, to empower the marginalized, to insist that Black lives matter. We have been angered. We have been saddened. We have been pushed to the brink once more. We are also inspired and seem resolved to do better this time. To not simply get to the other side of this moment, but to get there morally healthier, to get to a safer space for Black bodies. Spirit, help us to understand that we each have a role in justice work, for our liberations are tied to one another's. Give us the clarity of mind to know what our individual part is in the struggle, that there are many ways to protest injustice. Help us to find our way and commit to it. Spirits, we ask for guidance. Send us strength and endurance. Help us to give our all to this and to hold nothing back. For precious lives depend on it. We will be imperfect. Rest assured that we will mess up over and over again, and we must do it anyway. May we summon the courage to tear down this system of injustice and get busy creating a world community with justice for all. May it be so, and amen. For a benediction today, I'm going to go back to 12 words. 12 words that Forrest Church used as his mantra. And as some of you know, Forrest Church was a prominent UU theologian of the last century and early part of this century. And I always feel a certain kinship with Church because he and I were born 6 weeks apart. Unfortunately, we lost Forrest Church 11 years ago. But Church's words that became his mantra are still very much alive today. And I think it might be worth, after you hear this, writing these words down, thinking about them, and sort of reflecting on what Church used as his guidepost for his life. Church said, "Be who you are. Want what you have. Do what you can." Be who you are. Want what you have. Do what you can. And finally, for a postlude today, I asked Donica to insert in the service this song, which some of you know, some of you do not. Many of you who don't know it will probably become more familiar with because the National Football League has decided that when they open their football season, if they do open their season, opening weekend, in each of the stadiums, "Lift Every Voice and Sing," the Black National Anthem, will be played and sometimes sung. This anthem was written by James Weldon Johnson and his brother, J. Rosamond Johnson. James writing the words and J. Rosamond Johnson the music. It was first performed in 1900 by 500 black youth who were attending a segregated school in Florida. And it was sung in celebration of Abraham Lincoln's birthday. Singing this today is an a cappella group from Oakwood University in Huntsville, Alabama, named Committed, and will literally end the service today on a high note.
Lift every voice and sing, sing earth and heaven ring. Rejoicing, rise high as the listening skies resound, the rolling sea. Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us. Facing the rising sun of our new day, begun us, march on till victory is won. Stony the road we trod, bitter the chastening rock felt in the days when hope unborn has died, yet with a steady beat have not our weary feet come to the place from which our Father sighed. We that when tears have been watered, we have come treading our path through the blood of the slaughter, out from the gloomy past. Till now we stand at last where the white gleam of our star is cast. God of our weary years, Is our God where we met thee. Lest our hearts, drunk of the wine of the world, we forget thee. Shadow beneath